Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Sarah Hart. She's an emerita professor of mathematics at Birkbeck, University of London. She's also the 33rd Gresham Professor of Geometry, actually the first woman to hold the position since its inception in 1597. And today we're talking about her book, Once Upon a Time, The Wondrous Connections Between Mathematics and Literature. So, Dr. Hart, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so start by telling us, how did you get interested in these connections between mathematics and literature, and how did you first start noticing them?
I think my mind has always enjoyed structures and patterns, and they are there in literature, they're there in mathematics. So on a perhaps less conscious level, the things that I would enjoy in part in poetry and other kinds of literature are the same as the things I enjoy in mathematics. So on that level, always. But kind of in a conscious way, I would say that the trigger for all of the investigations I've done into these links between mathematics and literature was when a friend pointed out to me or mentioned that there is a particular mathematical curve that is discussed in Moby Dick by Herman Melville. And so I thought, oh, well, I'll read Moby Dick, which I hadn't done. It's one of these classic books, you know, that you're supposed to have read, but I hadn't. But I read it and it's wonderful. But throughout, I saw that there are lots of mathematical references and metaphors, allusions throughout that book and in actually lots of Melville's writing. And that really got me interested in, okay, what, how has this happened? Why are there all these links? Why are there all these metaphors in this writing? And that got me into exploring more broadly the mathematical literary links that there are in so many books and poems and everywhere, really.
So we'll come back to Moby Dick later on, but I mean, just generally speaking, in what ways does mathematics manifest in the structure of literary texts?
So, yeah, at the level of structure, I, as a mathematician, of course, believe that the best way to understand structure and pattern is using mathematics. And that's why, you know, it's so useful for science because the universe itself has lots of structure and pattern and symmetry, and mathematics is really our language for describing those things. So, for example, if you have a poem, it's difficult to say exactly what is poetry. It's hard to give a precise definition, but there will be some kind of constraint or structure, whether that's line breaks, you know, the meter, the rhyme scheme, if there is one. All of those structures and patterns you can think about mathematically, and you can ask questions like, well, how many ways are there to have a rhyme scheme? How many possible rhythms are there? And so mathematics underlies all of those sorts of structures.
And so, talking specifically about poetry, because poetry sometimes it's a bit of a weird thing. It's like one of those things that we can tell when it's poetry when we see it, but it's very hard to define, right? Because there are many different ways of doing poetry, and sometimes there's not even rhymes nor anything like that. So, but from your perspective as a mathematician, what do you find interesting about poetry, and in what ways do you think that mathematics can perhaps help us understand a little bit better what poetry or how poetry works?
Yeah, so I think that the two disciplines, mathematics and poetry, they kind of share some sort of aesthetic sensibility, in my view, because if you're a mathematician, you want to find out what the truth is, and then you want to express that in as beautiful, elegant, and probably quite concise way as you can. So if you want to prove that something is true, your proof, you want it to cover all the cases in as efficient way as you can. You want a nice, beautiful, clear piece of reasoning to get you to the end, not 400 pages of case-by-case calculations, right? So meanwhile, the poet wants to find the truth and express it in a beautiful way as well, and usually also in a fairly concise way where each phrase or each part of the poem will probably have lots of layers of interpretation. And that's one of the things we see in good poetry, is you might have a metaphor that actually carries lots of meaning in just a few words. And that's kind of the same thing as we do in mathematics. We want to cover lots of meaning in a few words. And we might do that with algebra or equations, whereas in poetry, you do it with metaphors and similes. So there are these aesthetic links between the two things. And lots of poets and mathematicians have seen these connections and kind of said, you know, there's a famous quote by the 19th century mathematician Sofia Kovalevskaya, who said, "It's impossible to be a mathematician without being a poet in your soul." You know, we are both looking for beauty and truth, and we're both trying to express it in a similar kind of way. So that's one level at which they're linked. But at the structural level, you can think about the different constraints that poets can apply. So there are different poetic forms. You know, a sonnet has various rules. It has a certain number of lines. It has a certain rhythm. It has a certain rhyme scheme different in different languages, actually. So an English sonnet tends to have a different rhyme scheme from a French sonnet, but they all will have these constraints. Within that, you can be creative and explore the playground of what you can do. Mathematically, so you might say, well, you can write a sonnet without being a mathematician. Of course you can. But I think knowing and understanding, appreciating those rules, of course you have to know what the rules are in order to be able to create the thing. But also understanding the rules allows you to play with the form, with different kinds of form, creating new forms and having fun with the consequences of those. So one example I give in the book is this French poet who wrote, there was a little tiny book and it purported to contain 100 trillion sonnets. And he did that by exploiting kind of the mathematics of combining poems. So what he actually had was 10 poems on 10 pages, and these are sort of the seeds. Mm-hmm. And then what you can do is actually created, it's sort of a three-dimensional poem, because each individual sonnet on each page, those 10 sonnets respected the sonnet form, and so they had their rhyme scheme within them. But then the layers of sonnets that he created, so 10 sonnets kind of in a pile, all of the first lines rhyme with each other, all of the second lines rhyme with each other. So he's made a three-dimensional poem. And then what you can do is you can create more sonnets from these by picking any of the first lines, and then any of the second lines, and any of the third lines, and so on, until you've got 14 lines chosen from these 10 initial poems. And so the number of sonnets that then are potentially can exist is 10 choices for the first line times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, 14 times, which is this 100 trillion. And that's very cool, I think, that he's got a three-dimensional poem which contains within it the potential for 100 trillion sonnets. So yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, and this is very interesting, because actually many times we tend to think that perhaps being a good artist, like a poet or something like that, I mean, the real ingredient there is to be to have as much liberty as possible in terms of the creative style, but actually it seems that having some rules set in place helps one being more creative,
right? Yes, exactly. I mean, it's rare to have no kind of structure at all, and even that is a choice. You then are choosing to do something with randomness. There's a great quote from the Irish poet Paul Muldoon, who said, I've got to get this right, he said that poetic form is a constraint, okay, and it's a straitjacket in the same way that straitjackets were a straitjacket for Houdini, okay? he's using that thing to give you something exciting, and that's what... Yeah. That these any kind of constraint in literature, it doesn't restrict your creativity. It actually spurs you on to work within that setup, whatever you've done, whether it's a poem with a particular rhyme scheme or set of constraints, or you know how many words or what the the form it has to fit into, or, you know, various literary forms where people say, okay, I'm going to have this length of chapter, or I will have paragraphs, or I won't have paragraphs, or I'll have, you know, a stream of consciousness thing with no sentences at all. All of those are choices. And so it's not that, yeah, we will have some kind of constraint and some kind of choice, and you can make those choices at every level of the text.
And so, still on the topic of poetry, in what ways can mathematics be applied to rhyme schemes? I mean, is mathematics something that poets use to create rhyme schemes or not?
Yeah, so you can apply mathematics to understand what the possibilities are for your rhyme schemes. So if you think of, in Western poetry, typically, what you're looking at is the stress of the words. So in your iambic pentameter, which is a kind of classic rhythmic meter, you've got kind of di-dum, 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 right? So that's one of the choices that you can have. There are various others with complicated classical names, which you don't need to worry about. But the number of possibilities that you have, if you have three syllables, say, you can stress the first syllable or not, you can stress the second syllable or not, third syllable or not, and actually that means there are eight possibilities. And so you can work this out mathematically, you can explore which ones are fruitful, which ones are not. But in different traditions, there are different ways in which the kinds of poetry are decided. So in kind of Indian poetry, instead of having stress or not stress, you have long and short sounds. And the number of ways of dividing a particular number of, you know, length of time into long and short sounds actually turns out to give you what we call the Fibonacci sequence, which is a well-known sequence that crops up all over the place in mathematics. But that sequence, which we call Fibonacci sequence because it was written down in, you know, in the West, in Europe first, by this guy Fibonacci, Leonardo of Pisa, in about 1202, somewhere around then. It had been known in India for centuries previously because it was so useful for understanding the different possibilities for structuring your poetry. So, yeah, mathematics can be extremely useful for understanding what possibilities you have. And then, of course, the artist in you can say, okay, I will choose this one and see what I can do with it.
But do you know if there are many poets and other types of writers out there that actually consciously structure their poems or their narratives, for example, and we'll get into novels in a second, but structure basically their work in a conscious way mathematically? Because, I mean, we also have this very common idea, which of course might be wrong to some extent, that people who are interested in art, in literature and all of that are not very good at mathematics and vice versa. But perhaps that's actually not true, I don't know.
I think, of course I would say this, but I really don't think it's true. I think there is that stereotype, but it's a tragedy actually of and I think quite unique to the time that we're living in, that there is this perceived difference between mathematics and science on the one side and art and all, you know, creative things. Yeah. As if, you know, they don't. And I mean for a start, if you do mathematics at, you know, research mathematics level, you have to be creative, because you're creating and exploring new ideas, you're putting ideas together in a new way, and that is a creative thing. And I feel, you know, as a mathematician, when I'm doing research, I feel much more akin with, you know, an artist who is creating designs, or a poet or a writer. So there's that thing. Mathematics, I think it has the misfortune to be very useful. You know, like, it's so useful for science that has somehow become what it's perceived to be for. It's as if we said that actually the purpose of art is technical drawing, or, you know, floor plans or something. That is not the purpose of art. It happens to be useful to be able to draw if you're going to be, I don't know, an architect or design machines, but that's not what art is for. And, you know, for me, that's not what mathematics is for. It just happens that it's very useful. But that's not all it is. So this perceived difference is really not there if you look, you know, on close inspection. There have always been writers and poets who have enjoyed mathematics. Mathematics itself, in many cultures, so if you, you know, Sanskrit mathematics, it was passed on via an oral tradition. That meant it was put into poetry. So books about mathematics from India, you know, 1,000 years ago, they are poems. And the problems are posed as poems, really beautiful poems about, you know, there's one I quote in Once Upon a Prime about a lovely little algebraical problem, but it's about a swarm of bees flying from one flower to the next, and some of them stop on this flower and some of them stop on this flower, and the question is to work out how many bees there were in total. So you get this lovely poetry which is describing mathematics, and you get mathematicians who are also poets, like Omar Khayyam, famous for the Rubaiyat, we still read, also did really brilliant work in algebra, and proved results that were not known in the West for 400 or so more years, using clever geometrical arguments. But of course, we remember him now as a poet, but he was these other things as well. So yeah, actually this dichotomy isn't really there in my view.
Right. So talking about novels now, can mathematics be used to, for example, structure a story?
Yes, absolutely. And there are several ways this can happen. So one way is by actually thinking about components of your story and how you're going to put them together. For instance, in terms of actual structure and length of the writing, one example I like to talk about is The Luminaries, which was Eleanor Catton's wonderful novel that won the Booker Prize in 2013. And she had lots going on in the book, lots of structure and themes. Kind of an overarching theme in the book was the interplay between chance and fate and how much we're in control of our destiny or not. And to illustrate that, she associates, there are 12 important characters, she associates them in some way to the signs of the zodiac. And then there are two main characters, the lovers, who are the luminaries, the sun and the moon. And so there's a lot of astrological information that she deploys, the 12 characters with their zodiac signs. She looks at kind of where the stars were in the sky at the exact time the events are set, and to some extent their actions are influenced by that, you know, in terms of what the characters will do. So she does that not necessarily because she believes in astrology, but because she wants to impose this outside thing to show, you know, actually, are we always in control? But mathematically speaking, the really interesting thing is what she does with the chapter lengths. And to kind of, again, associated with these astrological themes, there are 12 sections or chapters in the book. And kind of like the waning of the moon, each chapter is half the length of the one before. So you've got, this is in mathematics, we call a geometric progression, where you've got this constant kind of fraction each time that you multiply by. So there's a very long first chapter, and then the next one's half the length, half and half and half. So they quickly, and you feel it happening when you're reading the book, the chapters are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. That has a really interesting effect when you're reading the book. I mean, you don't necessarily know that that's exactly what's happening, because actually the implication of that mathematically, if you do like a half and then a quarter and then an eighth and then a sixteenth and something, you never actually get to one. So the whole of the book after chapter one, the total of that is actually less than the length of the first chapter all put together. So when you're reading this book, you don't know what's happening, because the first half of the book is kind of all within this first section. But then as it carries on, it picks up pace, you feel kind of the gears are turning, things are getting spiraling in on these two main characters. And so you get this quickening of the pace, the action is speeding up. The sun and the moon characters, their fate is being kind of determined around them, and they're losing control of the situation. So it makes for a really good read. It's a fantastic book, and that mathematical structure really adds to it. And that for me is an important criterion. Don't just impose some random thing. Don't say every third word must begin with L or something. That you could do that, and that's a constraint. But unless there's a compelling reason that this will enhance the narrative, then that will not be worth doing. And it's the same thing in mathematics, because in mathematics we don't just have any old rules for any old reason. We set up the rules of geometry, for example, the axioms, for a reason. It's because we think this is related to what's happening in the real world. That's so we don't have complete randomness in mathematics. And when you have mathematical constraints or structures in literature, the best ones, the ones that really work, are the ones that are done for a good reason, and that they enhance and, complement the themes and the narrative of the novel.
And I would imagine that having this sort of, or setting up these sort of constraints, like in the example you explore there, I mean, it's not only a matter of structuring the narrative in terms of the number of chapters, the number of paragraphs, for example, and stuff like that, but also, I mean, if we are structuring already the narratives by saying that, oh, it will have X number of chapters, I would imagine that that also has implications in terms of narrative choices, right? In terms of the content that we will include in each chapter and how the story will probably progress, right?
Exactly, yes. So if you've got a particular plan and how many chapters and the length of the chapter, of course, in this example, the final chapter is extremely short, just
Yeah.
kind of half a page. And so not much can happen in that chapter, but it's the final chapter. So thinking about how that will end up, and without giving away anything, it's a conversation between the two key characters. By which time, and chronologically, that's not the end of the story. So it does interesting things with the chronology, this book. It weaves around. And so actually this discussion is somewhere in the middle of the chronology of events. But of course, you are understanding it, knowing everything else that's already happened, unlike the two main characters. So yeah, there are these choices affect the narrative, affect your choices of how to tell the story, in what order, whose voice, and so on. Absolutely, yeah. And there's another example where there's a specific number of chapters, and that is kind of done to elaborate on a metaphor that runs through the whole book, and it's Life of Pi, a very different book, Jan Martel. And there's this lovely symbolism through the book. So in that book, it tells the story of this boy, Pi Patel. So Pi is his nickname because his full name is Piscine, the French for swimming pool, but unfortunately that sounds like a slightly ruder word in English. And so he shortens his name to Pi. That's his name. But he meditates through this book, which is a dreamlike account of a shipwreck at sea, and you're constantly not quite sure, has this happened? Is he How reliable a witness is he of the events that he's recounting? But he meditates through the book on Pi, his name, which is also this mysterious number. We know what it is. It's the ratio of the diameter of a circle to the circumference. So in that case, in that sense, we fully know what it is. But if you try and write down the number pi, it never ends, it never finishes, it's mysterious, it's irrational. That means in mathematics, it means you can't write it as a fraction. But then, of course, there's this other meaning in English. If someone's irrational, perhaps they're not making logical sense. So is pi irrational is the kind of punning really subtext of the whole of that novel. And so in the novel, he wishes, he says, I hate, my name, this number that goes on forever, because stories should have an end and a beginning and an end, and pi doesn't. And so he says, okay, pi may not have an end, but wouldn't it be great if I can tell this story in exactly 100 chapters? And he does tell the story in exactly 100 chapters. And so he's sort of playing constantly in the novel with the idea of the irrationality of pi, the fact that pi goes on forever, but that it's also a ratio we can understand. And one of the ways he plays with it is to have exactly 100 chapters. So it does finish, even though pi, the number, does not.
So there are also other ways in which mathematics manifest in novels and other kinds of writings in this case. So And one of them is how they are sometimes used as symbols in fiction, right?
So there are several numbers that are used all over the place in fiction, in fairy tales, in folk tales, in religious texts, that there are particular numbers that crop up over and over and over again. And three, for instance, is I'm probably the winner of these numbers. But if you think of religious texts, you get lots of threes, but you get 12s and sevens and perhaps 40. Those sort of numbers crop up a lot. Anthropologists call them pattern numbers. And three in particular happens a lot. It occurs a lot in stories, particularly fairy tales. So if you think of your fairy tales of your youth, and of course every culture will have different ones, but I remember there you always get three wishes, and there might be three sisters or three witches or three brothers going on a quest, and there are three little pigs, there are three billy goats, Gruff, I don't know if that was a fairy tale, Goldilocks will meet three bears, all of these things happen. And you can think sort of mathematically why that might be. Three is a number which has lots of wonderful mathematical properties, but perhaps for narrative, the interesting one is that actually, if you imagine points, if you're just drawing points, if you have one point on its own, if we think of a story where perhaps there are three princes and they're going on some quest, and always what happens in these stories is the first two princes do the same thing and they get it wrong, and then the third one, who's overlooked and the youngest but also the best, comes along and succeeds. So if you imagine, okay, we have a point, that's the first prince doing whatever the first prince will do. Well, if you draw a point in the plane, you've just got a point. There's nothing, you don't know, there's no pattern, you don't know what's going on. If you draw another point, then you can then draw a line between them. And in our narrative, what that tells you is you've got a pattern, you've set up an expectation. The second prince, he also does the same bad, silly thing, whatever it is. And now you have an expectation. But then, if you draw a third point, you can draw it over here. You subvert the expectation and you've gone up fully a dimension because now you can make an actual shape, make a triangle. And in the story, the third person does something different. And that is a surprise and that grabs our attention. And you get it in jokes as well. There are lots of jokes where, you have three people and whatever stereotype is prevalent in the country at the time, but there's two normal people and one idiot, right? And the two normal people do the normal thing, and then the idiot does something stupid. And again, it's the same thing. You've set up an expectation which requires two, and then three allows you to subvert it. So that narrative structure is very prevalent because of the number three. And there are, other things we could discuss about the number, but yeah, and you also get kind of big numbers occur, usually big powers of 10, because of course we count we count in base 10 usually. So you might have hundreds or thousands, or in Ireland, when you go to Ireland, you get 100,000 welcomes. In China, for your birthday, you are wished that you will have 100 birthdays. So these big numbers also appear in kind of phrases quite a lot. Yeah, but it's really interesting to look at, why that might be mathematically.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I mean, some of what you mentioned there, particularly about the number three, here in Portugal, we have tons and tons of jokes which include three people. It's always the Englishman, the Frenchman, and then because we live in Portugal, the Portuguese.
Yeah, so and every country will have its selection of three people.
But by the way, I was just thinking about the number seven in particular. I mean, just as an example, it just came to mind. But since it's also very frequently used, I was wondering to what extent that would be culturally influenced because, for example, we have 7 days of the week and stuff like that. Or even if the 7 days of the week, along with the use of the number seven in literature, fictional literature, stem basically from the same underlying mathematical thing, let's say.
I mean that, yeah, it's an interesting one, and it's there's always, I think, a balance between there'll be a mathematical reason, and then but there's quite often either some sort of cultural reason or a natural reason. Sometimes there's even a biological reason. I mean, you know, we have this is why we have 10. So there's no mystery to that. And of course, then you can say, well, mathematically, that's why we have stories mention hundreds and thousands and big powers of 10 as big numbers. And they also you also get the phenomenon where if you want to say some a number is really big, you give a power of 10 and then you add one to it, 1001 Arabian Nights, for example. But in the case of seven, I think there are various theories about why, perhaps astronomical reasons why people might think seven is important. Like there was, you know, a long time ago before telescopes, you could see the sun and the moon, and you knew about the Earth, and then you could there were only like five planets you could see. So there's somehow seven heavenly bodies that we can. That we know that move around, kind of thing. So maybe there's something to do with that. But mathematically speaking, I think seven is an interesting number because it's a prime number, and it's quite small, but it's a prime number. And because of that, you can't break it up in any easy way. So prime numbers, ones that they're only divisible by like themselves and one. So five is an example, three as well, seven. If you have something like six, you can break it up into twos and threes, and that although there are some very interesting properties of the number six, it doesn't then have this somehow this strength that a prime number will have. So if you think about rhythms and various kinds of poetry, actually, if you want if you have seven things, you can't break them up into a smaller bits. So it's got this power of irreducibility somehow, and I think that's probably what's going on there with seven and also with five.
And what do things like turns of phrase, metaphors, allusions have to do with mathematics?
Sorry, say again. I didn't.
Turns of phrase, metaphors, allusions.
So this comes back to what we were saying earlier, that actually mathematics and enjoying mathematics does not have to be and historically was not different from being creative and doing these other things. So of course everyone's different and people have different likings for different subjects, but there are lots of authors historically and I'm sure now who enjoy mathematics and it's kind of part of the furniture of their brain. And so when they are reaching for a metaphor or an allusion or some imagery, sometimes it's a mathematical idea that comes to them. So this is, you know, Herman Melville's one of these people. George Eliot is another. James Joyce, they enjoy mathematics, and so that might come to their mind as a way to illustrate an idea. And actually, that there's one phrase that we all have as it's a mathematical comes from a mathematical problem that's 2,000 years old. But certainly in English, we talk about squaring the circle. As you know, that's a circle you can't square, we'll say, if it's a puzzle, a problem that can't be solved or a difficult question. And I think people, like with all metaphors, you know, you use them without necessarily consciously thinking of what the metaphor comes from. But that to me is it's fascinating that this ancient Greek problem of geometry, which actually is impossible, but it took, I don't know, 1800 years to prove that you can't square the circle. So this is the problem of if you've got a circle, can you construct with like ruler and compass a square with the same area? That's the question. You can't. But this was one of the, you know, big problems of ancient Greek geometry. Can we do this? And this has entered our language as a phrase, squaring the circle, which is, you know, very interesting to me that happened, because it meant at some time there's enough people who genuinely know about this geometry problem for everyone to go, oh yes, that is a problem that's very difficult, you know? So there are these phrases that kind of everybody knows, but then specific authors, particular authors, have, just because they like mathematics and it sticks in their mind, they will use particular allusions that are mathematical. And of course I enjoy spotting those.
And so tell us about a few of those in Moby Dick, since you mentioned that book earlier.
So Moby Dick, of course, it's a very rich text. It has lots and lots of metaphor in it and symbolism from, a huge range of sources. And to say it's a story of going on a whaling ship and hunting whales does not cover in any way what it is. Of course, it's not just a seafaring yarn, but Ishmael, the narrator, he signs up as a deckhand on a whaling ship, the Pequod, and of course, then Captain Ahab takes them on this ultimately doomed mission to find the great white whale, Moby Dick. Ishmael just sort of has a lot of, he thinks a lot of thoughts, and a lot of them are mathematical. For example, that there are times when he's looking out at the ocean and he talks about the infinite progression of the waves. And there's this idea again of a geometric progression that I mentioned earlier, where they've got a bigger wave and then a slightly smaller one and a smaller one and smaller one, and that's a nice analogy. He talks about the fin of a whale as being like the gnomon of a sundial, so the part that sticks up in a sundial, and has some mathematical ideas relating to that. He uses the whole ship actually as making a big number. He talks about the hoops, circular hoops, and then the sails that are sticking upwards as making a one with loads and loads of zeros after it to represent the advanced age of one of the members of the crew, Fedallah. The crew members themselves use mathematical allusions. So there are Captain Ahab at one point, he wants to say that the cabin boy is very loyal, and he says, "You're loyal like the circumference to the center," which is, the circumference of the circle loyally stays always the same distance from the center. So that's a nice allusion as well. And then there are these references by various of the officers on board. So Stubb, who's the second mate, talks about using mathematics texts to do calculations, and he almost finds mathematics like magic. So he talks about the cabalistic contrivances of these mathematical symbols that he's using. Ahab does calculations on his ivory leg. Ishmael loves the data and statistics about whales so much that he has them tattooed on his skin because he had nowhere to write them. So there's all of this going on. And then just a final one, my favorite allusion or discussion is one day Ishmael is just sort of daydreaming again while he's cleaning these great big cauldron-like vessels called tripods, where they render the whale oil very messy, and then they have to clean them. And he's just cleaning this thing, and he notices that whenever he accidentally drops the soap that he's using to clean, that it always reaches the bottom of this big pot in the same amount of time. And he says, "This was when I was kind of struck by this fact of geometry that there's a curve where this is true," and the curve is called a cycloid. And it actually, that's a curve that was studied by every mathematician you can think of in the 17th and 18th century: Galileo, Newton, Leibniz, Descartes, Fermat, Bernoulli, Mersenne, all of them, all of the famous names study this curve. It was really, it's a fascinating curve. But Melville just drops it in, to Moby Dick, which is really lovely to see.
And another thing that sometimes writers do in their novels is that they actually feature mathematical themes themselves. Either they are actually sometimes part of the plot or sometimes referenced by, for example, characters or something like that to explain part of the narrative or to make it more compelling. So, what would be some examples of that?
So we'd mentioned earlier Life of Pi, which has this sort of regular discussion of the number pi compared to the character pi. Of course, we have to mention Alice in Wonderland because that is written by a mathematician, Charles Dodson, who used the name Lewis Carroll for this, for his fiction writing. And there are loads of mathematical ideas in Alice in Wonderland, but almost the whole book and the sequel, Alice Through the Looking Glass, are kind of discussions or explorations of logic, mathematical logic. Because repeatedly, what happens with Alice, there'll be some idea or some strange thing that happens, and it's a sort of strange logic, because it's not something that can happen in reality, but then there are consequences of it. So she shrinks and grows repeatedly in the book, and if you can shrink to a tiny size, then logically you could swim in a lake of your own tears, right? And that's exactly what happens at the beginning of Alice in Wonderland. So there are these sort of logical consequences, and there are various jokes and puzzles around logic and scenes where people discuss, this happened, and then Alice will say, oh, well, if that happened, then the next there's this would result, and they say yes, and then they get themselves tangled in a logical knot. So this kind of reductio ad absurdum idea in mathematics that is a genuine way of proving things in mathematics is really the whole of Alice in Wonderland, is one big reductio ad absurdum. So that, for me, that's what's going on there. Perhaps Close to the Surface is another book which very different in spirit from, the Moby Dicks and the Ulysses, other things we might discuss. But Jurassic Park, right? Which, of course, we've probably all seen the film Jurassic Park, but it was a book first, and one of the big themes of that is the idea of chaos theory in mathematics, where you can start off feeling like you know what's going on, but then the system becomes chaotic and kind of exponentially you lose control of what's going on. And we know this is a phenomenon in kind of weather forecasting, where the issue is, however close the initial conditions that you put into your model, after some time they start to diverge, and then you will have no idea what's going on. So to illustrate this idea, and one of the ways people talk about it is that the butterfly effect, right? That somehow the difference between a butterfly flapping its wings or not in the Brazilian rainforest 2 weeks later means there's a hurricane or there isn't. So in the context of setting up a theme park full of dinosaurs, even if you think you know what's going on and got everything set up and under control, perhaps that is not what's going to happen. So, that's one of the themes that's discussed in Jurassic Park. And to do that, so there's a mathematician character called Ian Malcolm who is kind of there. His purpose in that book is to explain these ideas and to be the one who's saying, oh, you better be careful, you might get eaten by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's he's like the prophet of doom here, explaining mathematically why you should not have such hubris to do what these guys are planning. But in the book itself, there's a really nice kind of extra thing, which is that the book is divided into seven sections, seven, again, seven sections. And at the start of each section, there's a little curious little picture. And each section, it's the same picture, but it gets more complicated. And this picture is actually a mathematical thing called a fractal, which is a kind of curve that you produce with an iterative process. So you do the same thing over and over and over again. It might be like each time you have a line, replace that line with a little zigzag or something. And so you repeat this process over and over again, and what you end up with is extremely complicated and hard to predict, whereas the first picture is just a few simple straight lines. So that's, and again, he's using fractals to illustrate the idea of chaos theory, which is already itself mathematical. So that's very nice.
And I mean, how accurately do you think these sort of mathematical themes tend to be explored in fiction? Because sometimes, I mean, particularly when it comes to, I don't know, fiction that is based on crime, for example, Dan Brown's books, Da Vinci Code, and all of that. I mean, sometimes it gets a little bit into conspiracy theories. Of course, in that particular case, it's not that I guess he's trying to connect it with real world conspiracy theory. It's just for the sake of the narrative there. But yet, it seems to me that sometimes perhaps writers misunderstand a little bit what they're using there mathematically.
I think so. There are a couple of ways that mathematics can be deployed in a less successful way. And one of them is where you just have, this might happen more in science fiction maybe, but you've got something that you want your characters to be able to do, which is essentially impossible. And so you drop in some maths person to say, oh, well, I can, asymptotically integrate the differential matrix of the toroidal surface, some meaningless phrase, and then magically the problem is solved. So that can happen, just a parachute of some incomprehensible mathsy words strung together. That's a possibility. Another thing that can happen is, that your mathematics is just not, you know, may not be correct. So in Dan Brown's books, he has a lot to say, you know, that lots of cryptography mentioned in there. So what usually will happen is he'll say some big cryptography words, but then actually the characters will have to crack a code that is incredibly easy to crack. And I think in one of his books, there was some cipher that they struggled with, and then they realized the key to solving this, that there's a number you had to know, was a prime number, and I won't tell you which book, but because I don't want to spoil the enjoyment, but anyway, the prime number involved, I think, turned out to be 3, which of course is not, that is not an uncrackable code. So if you're encoding the whole of the secrets of you know, the universe, and you know, you've got this ages old, millennia old secret that blows apart, you know, all of Christianity or something, you don't hide it in a piece of paper that just involves a simple anagram. You know, like, so that to me, I mean, it's fun, right? I don't mind, I don't object, but it's not really proper cryptography that he's doing there. So yeah, that's one thing. And he also says a lot about the golden ratio, which is to do with the Fibonacci sequence. He says a lot about that is not really, not what I would absolutely stand behind as a mathematician. So there's that sometimes. You do also get some sort of tropes around mathematician characters and about, you know, it's a lazy way for authors to say someone's a genius is to make them solve Fermat's last theorem, you know, and find a short little proof of it or do some amazing bit of mathematics. And that to me is problematic for more than one way. One issue with that is that it perpetuates this myth that mathematics is some weird thing and you have to be a genius to do it. Otherwise it's completely alien and there's no point even thinking about it. Which is that's incorrect. There are some geniuses in the world, but most mathematicians, we're just normal people who are just happen to enjoy mathematics and like playing around with it, and it's fun. And you know, we don't insist that to engage with music that you have to be a concert pianist. We don't insist that to play football or to go for a run you have to be an Olympic athlete. So that's a weird problematic thing that we do with mathematics, to say either you're a genius and probably insane, or maths is not for you. So the stories where you have a crazy person or someone who's driven mad by their mathematical genius, they are not to my taste, let's say.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that sometimes these stereotypes that writers might use are just an oversimplistic way of getting away with portraying someone as highly intelligent, just because they put them in the text doing something or solving a problem, but that just so happens that many people out there are just not aware of, and so they don't have the proper, let's say, cognitive tools to understand that it's much easier to solve than they make it, or sometimes it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Exactly. Yeah, and you do get, I mean, there are amusing incidents that you see, that there's a film, do you remember the film Good Will Hunting came out a few years ago? And so it has Matt Damon as this, you know, mathematical genius, but he's working as a janitor. But the moment of, you know, discovery is when he sees a problem that's been set by the math professor and left on the blackboard, and he just quickly solves it, and therefore he's a genius. But if you're a mathematician, who has studied the area that this problem comes from, is called graph theory, and actually it's an elementary problem that, you know, you would set to your undergraduate students, and so this guy can solve it. It's like, okay, it's, you know, it's nothing. It's like, oh, it's well, okay, so you know Pythagoras's theorem, you know, it's a very simple kind of problem. So it can be fun if you're a mathematician to just spot those little things that are amusing, but yeah, it actually there's another amusing instance of that in literature. So one mathematician character in literature that people may have heard of but don't remember that they're a mathematician is Sherlock Holmes's nemesis, Moriarty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is in the books you read that he is a mathematician. He's published, you know, amazing mathematical texts, and he was actually a professor of mathematics at a university in England. But then he gives up that, maybe the salary isn't high enough, I don't know. He gives all that up and becomes the Napoleon of crime. But The in the in the one of the Sherlock Holmes stories where he's introduced this character, he says that he it's his treatise on the binomial theorem that gets him this professorship. And the binomial theorem by that time was, I mean, it was several centuries old, and it was quite elementary. It's like being a professor of adverbs or something. You know, it's the wrong example to use, so it's just amusing that Arthur Conan Doyle describes him in this way, and he's this genius, but his actual dissertation is on a very elementary mathematical theorem.
Yeah, I guess that many of these has to do with just suspending your disbelief, because it's not only about mathematics, but even sometimes, particularly in crime stories and all of that. I mean, there are twists and things that happen that if you stop 10 seconds to think about it, they do not make any sense at all. But if you're just in the moment, like in the flow, reading the story and all of that, you don't even notice it. So
Yes. And you know, I have no objection to a bit of, we call it hokum. You know, there is no problem with just having a fun
yeah.
romp that is just takes you along for the ride. You know, that's completely okay with me. But you know, sometimes it's quite funny if you can just spot a little, oh, okay, that's not right.
And so, one last topic then. What about the idea of mathematics itself? I mean, when it happens that authors explore mathematics itself in books, in stories, how do you look at how they tend to present it? Do you think it's accurate or not?
Well, it very much depends. You know, there's a range of ways and range of authors. I think you do sometimes get the portrayals of, the mathematician who is a genius, but perhaps an oddball or something. But the ones I really like are where you get mathematician characters who are just, they are people. They're people like everybody, with good parts and bad parts, and they are three-dimensional personalities and characters. And where mathematics itself is presented as being kind of interesting and intriguing and fascinating and beautiful, because that's of course how I think of it. And I think one of my favorite authors for doing this is the playwright Tom Stoppard, who in several of his plays features mathematical ideas and themes. And my favorite of all his plays is Arcadia, which is the story of what it's set in two times. It's set in the present-ish day and in the start of the 19th century. And in the 19th century part of 1809, I think, there's this young teenage girl, Thomasina Coverley, who is kind of very good at mathematics, and she has lots of exciting ideas. She's got ideas that might kind of give a future hint of perhaps fractals, but she can't invent fractals yet because you need computers for fractals. And then she has these fun discussions about mathematical ideas with her tutor. But there's also a whole story going on about, did Lord Byron visit the house? And there's this intrigue going on between the present day and then. There's a sort of hint that maybe is this young girl supposed to resemble Ada Lovelace, who is this kind of early mathematician and Byron's daughter, but she is credited with writing the first computer program. So that character, Thomasina, is a joy. She's enthusiastic, she's bright, she's funny, she's silly, and all of those things. The mathematics he gets right. They have this fun discussion of Fermat's last theorem, and he doesn't fall into any of the mistakes that I've mentioned. You know, he doesn't have anyone prove it in five lines, and all of this. So they have this fun discussion of this and lots of other ideas, and his other plays as well. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is another great one, which was made into a film actually, about 20 years ago, I think. And there they have these discussions about probability, and if you throw a coin and it comes up heads 90 times in a row, you know, that could theoretically happen, but it feels wrong. So what's going on there? Why, you know, how can we understand probability in that context? So those are like good examples. But for me, yeah, the best mathematics, as you see it in writing, and the best mathematicians are the ones that are human beings. And the best, writers on mathematics get that right, and then it's fantastic.
And so let me just ask you one last question. What were your goals with this book? I mean, because it's a book for a general audience, what would you like for it to be like the what would you like for people to take away from this book? Particularly people that, I mean, they might be able to understand mathematics or but they might think that it's just too boring, or perhaps people that think that mathematics is just too hard and they don't even want to try to understand it or something like that.
Yeah, so I would say we are human beings are mathematical. Like our brains are wired mathematically. I think a lot of people get put off mathematics in school. And actually sometimes it can be boring in school because you have to do the same old calculations over and over and over again. You have to learn your times tables. That's not very interesting, but to me that's not what mathematics is. You know, that's okay, numbers, we have to be numerate, fine, it's a skill, but mathematics is about patterns and shapes and symmetries and links between things. And that the fact that that is there in literature for me is so exciting, and it's natural because we're human beings, and so our love of rhythm, which is mathematics, comes out in all of the creative things that we do. It's there in music, it's there in art, it's there in literature. And if you haven't made friends with mathematics yet, I hope that this book will just show you some of the ways in which even quite simple mathematical ideas have such power and can enhance your enjoyment of the books you already know and love, and maybe new books and new poetry that you haven't yet encountered. So it's not like a mathematics textbook. It is just an exploration of how just a few simple ideas that come from mathematics can really enrich the literature we already love and new literature we may not yet have seen. So yeah, I would encourage everyone to read it because even if you don't know yet that you like mathematics, maybe by the end of the book you might have a be willing to be friends with mathematics.
Yeah, and it's certainly a very fascinating read, and the book is again Once Upon a Prime, The Wondrous Connections Between Mathematics and Literature. I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. Dr. Hart, just before we go, apart from the book, would you like to let people know where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Yes, so I'm on, well, we can't call it Twitter anymore, but
Well,
whatever it is,
I still call it Twitter, actually,
yeah,
but
yeah,
anyway.
whatever that bird site, whatever it's called, I'm at Sarah Loves Maths with an S on the end. So unfortunately, yes, if you're American, you have to remember to add the S on the end. But you can also, I mean, if you Google me, you'll find my Birkbeck website, which I try to keep updated, although not always successfully. Yeah.
Okay, great. So, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been really fun to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting the show on Patreon and PayPal. The links are in the description down below. And also, please share, like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Per Galarsson, Jerry Muller, Hans Fredrik Sunde, Bernardo Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Kessel, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollison, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetrio, Robert Windegar, Rui Inácio, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormer, Samuel Andrew, Francis Forte, Agnunes, Fergal Cousin, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Jonathan Liebrandt, João Linhares, Tantanti, Samuel Correia, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sadus France, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londoño Correia, Annick Punter, Adana Rosmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pablo Stasevski, Nalec Bach, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, Simon Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Paul Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edwin Bronner, Douglas Frye, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortes, Ursula Litzke, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sonny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul Jorge Arnaud, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theofanos, Chris Williamson, Peter Wallazin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Erickson, Charles Morey, Alex Shaw, Amari Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry D. Lee Jr., Old Herringbone, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Grassi, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dobner, Luke Neeson, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Bensley-Mann, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Paul Crowley's, Kate Von Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, and David Pinsoff. A special thanks to my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Tom Vanagdam, Bernard Hugney, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alnick Ortiz, Nick Golden, and Rosie. And to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Codrian, and Bogdan Canivet. Thank you for all.